All right, we're back, the Stripe Show podcast into season two. And, you know, I got to thinking, we bring on right now during this off season, our, let's call it our second off season, but maybe for the players, it's really their first off season as they seem to be playing professional golf 12 months out of the year. And I reached out to this guy, former PGA Tour player, was the 22nd ranked player in the world in 2007, one PGA Tour win, two Korn Ferry Tour wins, and you probably recognize him the most recently as one of the top analysts on the Golf Channel. Welcome in, Aaron Oberholzer. How you doing?
Good, Travis. Thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
Yeah, I was excited when you accepted my request, because what I've been thinking about here with this episode of the podcast was really, you know, who's someone that could come in and talk about, you know, what we've seen maybe in the first quarter of the year on the PGA Tour, call it, you know, January through March, when the best players in the world have been playing, but also, you know, this relevant topic of instruction, the coaching world on the PGA Tour. Of course, you were a former terrific player on the PGA Tour. You've worked with some players. I've seen some videos of you helping players with instructional tips that you're putting out there. So I thought you'd be the perfect person. So I appreciate your time and look forward to digging in here a little bit on these two topics.
Absolutely.
Well, let's start with the first quarter of the year, you know, on the PGA Tour. You know, of course, it's a wraparound season, but really the best players, you know, they start to play in January. You look back, January through March, anything kind of jump out at you for the first quarter on tour?
Well, absolutely. The one theme that I started to see early on was how much confidence a lot of the players from the international side of the President's Cup team played so well. A lot of those guys who took a lot from Ernie and the way he captained that team and the way that they played down at Royal Melbourne. And they hung with the United States for a long time. And I think in their minds, they feel they should have won that cup. There's no doubt. They let it slip in the end in singles, where the U.S. in the past has been very strong in that format. Mm-hmm. But to see Cam Smith come right out of the gates and win Sony, Abraham Answer finishing second at the American Express, Mark Leishman with a win at Farmers and a second at API, and then Sung J.M., who I think we all feel might be the next, well, might be the best young player if you're looking at guys under the age of 25. I don't think there's any idea, there's any question that Sung J.M.'s that guy right now, the best player under the age of 25, winning the Honda, and just seems to put up good result after good result. And he's obviously first in the FedEx Cup as we stand right now. You know, that International President's Cup team really came out firing on all cylinders at the beginning of the year. And that's the one thing that kind of has stuck out to me towards the beginning of this year.
Yeah, that's a great point. You know, of course, as an American, I was cheering for the American team, but kind of there was a small piece of me that wanted the international team to win that. I mean, I'm a huge fan of Ernie Els, and those guys played hard. I mean, they were out there competing. They threw everything at the American team, but you got to handle it to them. The American team, they dug deep and got it done. You mentioned Sung Jae-im, which we'll get to here in the podcast, because I want to break his game down. What an impressive young player that he is. But let me throw this at you. As I look at the first half of the season, you go to the international team, which is playing some terrific golf. I look at a lot of the big names. Gosh, I mean, they were struggling. I mean, this stoppage in play has been a good thing for a player like a Brooks Koepka, who has really struggled. I look at DJ. He looks a little unmotivated to me in the first quarter of the year. Justin Rose has struggled. Ricky Fowler has struggled. The struggles continue for Jordan Spieth. These are big wholesale names that were certainly not sharp in the first quarter.
DJ is a little surprising, quite honestly. But when I, you know, what's going on with him technically, I'm not sure, quite honestly. I don't notice a lot of technical changes in his golf swing. He's actually hitting the highest percentage of fairways he's hit in the last 5 years right now at 62%. His greens in regulation is down quite a bit, though, over the last couple of years. And that may be for a number of reasons. It could be because he's attacking too much. Maybe he's making too much of approach play. But when I look at the numbers in a little deeper and I look at his proximity, where he was so good a few years ago when he won the U.S. Open and he did what he did on tour week in and week out, year in and year out, he had made it a point to be very good with his wedges. And right now he's well down the list of approximation to the hole from 50 to 125 yards, where he was in the top 10 of that category on a regular basis. And so, I mean, the average from 50 to 125, if I'm not mistaken, is right around 18, 19 feet. I don't have it right in front of me right now, but he's at 25 feet. And so that's a massive, massive loss for him for as long as he hits it, because he's still driving it fairly well. So I think that that's kind of where I see DJ's game right now from a statistical standpoint. He just needs to kind of pick that part of his game up. And I think he'll start playing a little bit better. Short game hasn't been great, but I also think he's leaving himself in spots with his irons that are, maybe he's attacking a little too much at times, being a little too over aggressive, and not giving himself good outs, and maybe making some ill-timed assessments on certain shots.
Yeah. Is it fair with DJ, who we're talking about Dustin Johnson here, the number five ranked player in the world? You mentioned his approach wedge game, which are great points, 50 to 100 and, 25 yard approach wedge play. Dustin Johnson has a TrackMan for one reason and one reason only, as I understand, and that is to see exactly how far the ball is carrying with his wedges. That's all he wants to see, is that one number up there. He's 162nd strokes gained short game, 106th putting. Is it fair with DJ to say, when you see these kinds of stats with the wedges, the finesse part of the game, that he's not perhaps putting the time in that he needs away from the golf course?
That could be, or him and Claude or Butch might be trying to do something different. I know they might be working on something else right now. Yeah. That it might be more pressing that I don't know about, quite honestly, that we all don't know about. That's the thing, is that, you know, from my standpoint, if I don't hear it straight from the player's lips, or I don't hear it straight from the coach's lips, I don't really buy it, quite honestly. And so I'm left to kind of looking at the statistics and making as educated of a synopsis as I can. And with his game right now, usually when one thing suffers in a player's game, it's almost getting cliche to say this, but when one thing suffers in a player's game, it's usually because he's putting onus on something else that needs a little bit more work, because there's just not enough hours in the day to practice everything.
Let's go to Brooks Koepka, world number two. He was number one. Rory, of course, passed him. Rory playing some terrific golf. He wanted to keep things going here at the Players' Championship before they raised the flag. But you know, Koepka, I felt like there was going to be some rust coming back from the injury, but it's been a little concerning, to say the least. You look at him right now, T43 at the Genesis. He missed the cut at the Honda, T47 at API. But, you know, the distance is still there, you know, which tells me that, all right, everything's in shape from a physical standpoint. But iron game, 128th approach. His putting, though, has been...
It's the putting.
His putting has been really, really bad.
It's been abysmal for Brooks. And Brooks is, you know, Brooks has got that rare combination when he's going to have that rare combination to be able to drive the ball miles and drive it very well, and then make putts when he needs to. And that's a very hard combination to have on a regular basis. But he's a good putter. And to see him putt the ball, and he says it himself, he's putting, it's terrible. His touch, his feel, his speed control. I was a little surprised. I mean, guys will try anything to kind of get out of a slump. I was a little surprised to see him go to that larger grip. I didn't think personally that was the answer for him. Cause I do believe that he is an athletic feel type, more type player, quite honestly. And I believe that personally, for most guys who go from a small grip to that bigger grip, if you've been putting with a smaller pistol style grip your whole life, and then you go to that big grip, that changes a lot of things in your stroke. And I didn't think when I saw that, I was like, that is just odd. And I said, he's searching. He's absolutely searching when I saw that. And so to see him go back now to that grip, the last of any play, then he went back to his normal grip. I think he's going to start to find his feel. Now, remember in 2018, when he had those issues with his wrist, and he was coming back from that wrist injury, he started a little slow, and then he started to get his feels back, and everything started to click again, and then boom, he wins two major championships. So I'm not too concerned. I'm not as concerned about Brooks as maybe some other guys are. I think he's going to find his form. This is a little different because he, you know, once he found out he could the wrist could handle what it needed to handle and there was no issues, he was good to go. I think he might have developed some other things with the longer layoff with the knee issue, and maybe he played a little longer on the knee than he should have, and maybe, just maybe, potentially he developed some bad habits with his golf swing. It happens to all kinds of players when they get injured, that kind of stuff. And potentially that was the issue with Brooks, because when he came back, he said, look, my knee's good. There's nothing wrong with my knee. I'm not protecting my knee. I'm 100%. I believe him. So in that case, something might have been kind of left over from what was going on with the knee prior to that. And it just snuck in. And subconsciously, as a golfer, you're going to protect something that's been injured and or worked on. You just don't know how it's going to react. So that stuff might have been just left over scar tissue from, or psychological, you know, scar tissue from where he was prior, and he let it bleed into his subconscious as he was coming back. It's going to happen to just about every golfer out there until you really realize that you're 100%, you're good to go. I can trust it. I can rotate. I can post on that knee. I can get into that knee. There's not going to be, you're not going to feel 100% mentally about it until it's absolutely there and you can hit the shots. So I think some of that stuff that he discovered maybe with Butch was something that he needed. And now that he's got that piece of the puzzle, this time off for a guy like Butch or a guy like Tiger, who needs that extra, that might need that extra little cushion of rest and or reps to really get their bodies and or game back in shape. These guys could really be fired on all cylinders when they come back. Potentially everybody's going to have competitive rust, but those two guys, they might've needed this break as much as anybody.
Yeah, no, I think it's fair. I think this break is going to serve Brooks fairly well. And you know, Ricky Fowler, who's taking on some swing changes with John Tillery, some pretty good size changes, by the way. I think this break's going to serve him well. I get the feeling with, you know, Dustin, he would rather just kind of continue to play and work through it. But, you know, May 21st is the target date right now, the Charles Schwab Cup for the tour out there at the Colonial. That might have the best field in golf ever, because everybody's going to be
no doubt. I mean, that could get at least half the top 50 in the world, at least half the top 50 in the world.
I agree.
I mean, I think Colonial right now is sitting there with their fingers crossed and just sitting down going, please, 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 let us be able to play, because they will get an incredible field if we can start playing that week.
Let's talk about some of these young guns here for a second. Then I want to transition into coaching and instruction out there on the PGA Tour. You know, Victor Hovland, what an impressive young man. I got to play with him last year down at the Arnold Palmer Invitational in the Pro-Am. I mean, the guy hits it as straight as a string. Colin Morikawa, who I'm really excited about to see his career. Of course, Matthew Wolf has the flash, has the power. You know, those are the three that get the headlines. But, you know, Sung Jae-im, of those four, I would say is the most impressive. What do you say?
I agree with you 100%. When you look at all these 21 and 22 year olds out there, and you can put Waco Neiman in there as well.
Yeah.
I'd say of those five guys, Hovland and Sungjae impressed me the most of those five guys. Now, it's not that I'm not impressed with Matthew Wolf. I love watching the guy play. But he's got a ways to go to build his game. He has the right stuff to be a world beater. Uh-huh. He hasn't put it all together yet in one package. And him and George Gankus are working on it for sure. And I believe he'll get there at some point, but it's going to take a little bit more time for him. Whereas I think Morikawa and Sungjae and Hovland, they come a little bit more packaged. Other than Hovland's chipping, which he admits sucks in his words, he says, that, you know, those guys don't have a lot of weaknesses. I mean, there's no weaknesses in Morikawa's game. You could look at his putting here and there, but there's really no weaknesses. And Sungjae, zero. Mm-hmm. You know, I'd have to say that the most upside right now is either Hovland and or Sungjae, just based on, you know, recency bias, obviously, with Sungjae and the way he's playing. But he's proved it over the last few years how good a player he can be. I think if Hovland figures out the chipping part, if he finds the right coach to help him figure out how he can get away from leading edge, diggy,
yep,
use the bounce properly, if he can find the right coach. And I believe from the grapevine, I've heard he might be looking at Pete Cowan for that. I'm not positive of that. That's just something I heard in passing. Don't take my word for it.
Yeah.
That would be a great start if that's the case. Because I think a lot of us think very highly of Pete as a coach.
Yeah, sure.
But if he fixes that, it's going to be a great battle. Now, the only thing that I would look at, I don't know how you feel, but the way I look at Colin Morikawa, the only thing he's lacking really in this whole deal is distance. You know, everybody talks about it's not as long. Well, he can do it like Spieth, you know, did for so long. Whereas, okay, you're going to average that tour average, 295, 296, 297. That's plenty long enough to get it done. You just got to be really good from 150 to 200 yards with your irons, which Spieth was incredible from that distance. And that's what allowed him, and he putted well, and that's what allowed him to be as good as he was and do the things that he did and win three major championships. I think Colin's going to have to get it done more that way. He's going to have to, his approach play from 150 to 200 is going to have to be impeccable, and his putting is going to have to be impeccable.
Yeah, those are great points. And it's funny when you look at players and you look at them statistically, you know, every player, there's usually something that jumps out at you that's like, okay, he needs to get better here. And as you mentioned with Victor Hovland, it's the chipping, it's around the greens. You know, Matthew Wolf, he's got the distance, but his accuracy is not great. I mean, he's way down there in strokes gained approach and with his iron play. I mean, he's got to get much tighter with that part of the game. And then Colin, who is more accurate, you know, he doesn't have the distance, as you said. And of course, we are very much in the distance era. I can remember sitting at PGA Tour headquarters doing some work for them, and we were going through it. It's when they announced Sung Jae Im as the Rookie of the Year last year. And I pulled him up and we were doing this voiceover work, and I was looking at his stats, and I thought to myself, he doesn't have any weaknesses.
No, zero.
I mean, this guy has good distance. He hits it relatively straight. He's right there in strokes gained approach. His short game was great last year. His putting was great last year. He slipped a little bit, I believe, this year around the greens. But he had zero weaknesses, Aaron, as a rookie on the PGA Tour. I mean, he is, he's an interesting guy. You know, he, as I understand, he doesn't have a house.
No.
In the United States. No one plays more tournaments than he does on the PGA Tour. He basically just travels week in and week out. Pretty much, I know he has a small team, but he's out there doing it on his own. And he is an impressive, impressive young man.
He is. He's very impressive. The one thing I like, though, when I see him out there, I don't see a massive entourage, to your point. And I love that. I love that. When I don't see a manager walking the fairways, or a short game coach, a swing coach, a dietitian, you know, you name it. When I don't see those guys all walking the golf course, I'm like, that guy, he wants to understand it himself. He wants to own it. And there's no doubt Sungjae owns every ounce of it. And he works hard. He works his butt off just like everybody else does out there. But he owns it right now. And he knows what he's doing 100%. And at 21 years old, good gracious, that is, I mean, the sky's the limit. I was asked the other day if he could be the best Korean player that there's ever been. Male, of course. The females have been ridiculously good. But the best male-born Korean player. And I said, no doubt. I think KJ had a phenomenal career, and he's kind of the benchmark for Koreans. And I think that at 21 years old, with a win under his belt and all the accolades now, I think Sungjae can get past 8 wins and a players and or a major. I think he's got that kind of game, and I think he will eventually supplant KJ Choi as the best Korean player to come out of the Korea from the male side, for sure.
Yeah, and if this is a great transition now into coaching, because he doesn't have that entourage following him around. And you know who else who doesn't have it as well is Rory McIlroy, Rahm. You know, these international players, I think it's fair to say, going at it a little bit more independently.
You can throw JT in there too. I mean, Mike's on the road with him, but Mike's not hovering over him overbearingly, like, you got to do this, you got to do that. You know, JT discovers things on his own too. I think Mike's there to help every once in a while, I've watched those guys interact a lot on the range, and Mike's not doing a whole lot. He's letting JT discover things for himself, which I really appreciate.
And so do I. And I think as we get into this coaching conversation on the PGA Tour, the timing of it is irrelevant. Of course, your colleague at Golf Channel, Brandel Chambly, his interview with Golf Week, he had a lot to say about modern coaching, some examples of coach-player relationships that are happening on the PGA Tour. And so let me start with this question to you, Aaron. You were a great player. You won the AT&T. You got to 22 in the world. I mean, you were a world-class player. Let me ask you, when you were out there in the peak, who did you counsel? Did you have a team? Did you ask anybody for help? How was it for Aaron Oberholzer as a professional golfer with a coach or coaches?
Entourages had started to show up when I was out there playing, to a certain extent.
Okay.
I can't remember offhand who had the entourages. I know, I want to say maybe it was more media, but I remember Shigeki Maruyama at majors. He'd have a pretty good entourage, and maybe that was more media. I didn't really pay close attention, but I do remember having certain guys where there were, I'd play practice rounds and all of a sudden here comes all the, you know, a few other people. I'm like, what is going on here? Why are there three people standing in my line? And so I would, for me, I'm super old school, Travis. I've had to learn and had to understand, I guess, to a certain extent, and maybe I don't agree with it all the time, but my coach, I've had two coaches my entire life, guys that I can call like real coaches. My first teacher, Roger Graves, God rest his soul, from Crystal Springs, who was the head pro there. And he was my coach from my freshman year in high school to my senior year in college. And he was Hogan, Nelson, Snead, Nicklaus. Boom. Anything, combine those. That's what he tried to teach me. Now, I didn't swing like those guys, but that was my interpretation of what he was telling me. Very old school, target oriented, you know, get your body to move towards the target and get that ball going where you want to start it. Very intuitive, very athletic. Then when I got out of school, I needed more. I felt like that had run its course, and I felt like I needed more because I missed first stage of Q school right off the bat. And I was an All-American, you know, a very good college player, and thought that I was just going to breeze right through Q school, get my card, and boom, I'm on my way. And I get slapped in the face first stage of Q school. So John Kennedy, who is now the San Jose State head coach, who was then the Santa Clara head coach, he's been my coach ever since. So two guys. And John really had really helped me on my trajectory as a player. And he took a lot of the stuff that Roger taught me, and John agreed with all the stuff because he's very much cut from the same cloth, but with a slightly new school vibe. And he's not, and he embraces technology, but he uses it sparingly only when need be, which I appreciated. But he was genius. He learned a lot of stuff from Freddie Shoemaker, who is fantastic. If you don't know who Fred Shoemaker is, he was a lot of process oriented stuff, routine oriented stuff, how to play the game at the highest level. And that's what I learned from John. It was very much process, routine, target orientation with a little bit of a change here or change here, very slight, easy to make those changes and then just keep going. I was such a field player and I was so hard headed and I had such a filter, Travis, that you couldn't tell me anything. I would look at you with such a disdain. If you told me this is what you should do, I would look at you with just the biggest stink eye. I'm like, dude, I'm the player. I could beat you left-handed. Why are you telling me this? That with that kind of attitude. But I think to a certain extent, that's kind of the attitude that I think players should have when they go into coaching, when they go in with a new coach. Question the coach. If they don't come up with the answers that you deem valid, then you need to get out of there. I mean, in a hurry, heartbeat, move on. Don't give them a month. Don't give them 2 months. Get out of there. So John was a great fit for me because he didn't try to change me. He didn't try to make wholesale changes. Now moving on from there, I had a cup of coffee with two, you know, what you would consider top 50 instructors. Okay. I had 4 months with Peter Costas, my rookie year. And I had literally one lesson from Butch Harmon, and I couldn't do I appreciated both those guys because they're obviously great teachers, but they weren't great for me because I couldn't do what they wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And they didn't speak my language. If that makes sense, you need to speak a lot of different languages if they want to truly be a great teacher. you've got to be able to communicate a lot of different ways the same thing. And maybe they were trying to say something to me that I wasn't understanding it, and or my body couldn't do at the time. So is it, it's probably 50% my fault, 50% their fault that they couldn't communicate it the way that they wanted to. That's kind of how I look at the teacher player relationship to a certain extent. It's a 50-50 thing. And I think that certain players, I will say this though, I put 1% more in the players bracket. I don't blame teachers. I am more apt to blame the player for staying too long than the teacher for teaching that player what he's teaching. If it does it, you as the player, you have the ultimate say. You are the one controlling the narrative. Mm-hmm. And if you don't like what that person's saying or that teacher's saying, then you need to question absolutely everything, like I said. And then if it's still not working, then you need to get out of there. But as the teacher, it's up to you. If that student really wants to learn and they're just not getting it, it's up to you. If you're not communicating the right way and they're not getting it, to go, look, man, I've tried everything under the sun and I'm sorry it's not working, but I want the best for you. So we probably need to start finding someone else for you that might help you out. Because not all teachers are right, quite honestly. They're not right. Some guys see things a different way or communicate things a different way that a player understands. Everybody speaks, like I said, different languages, and it's hard to find that matchup sometimes, Travis.
Yeah, it is. And you know, through that process, and you named Butch Harmon, Peter Kostas, who have helped so many, I assure you that they would tell you that they were not productive for as many players, if not more. You know, as a teacher, just for me personally speaking, you know, I have failed many times with students for just whatever reasons, right? It just, like, we just didn't communicate very well, or perhaps I wasn't doing the right things. There's a lot of success, but there's failure as well. And I think you learn from each one of those examples, and you go all the way up to the best teachers out there on the PGA Tour. Butch Harmon's probably had the most success. He's had a lot of setbacks as well that I'm sure he just kind of looked at me like, you know what it is, and you kind of chalk it up and you learn. My next question to you is, have we gone too far in the professional game? I mean, as far as this entourage, as far as these teachers, I know a lot of these teachers, I mean, they're traveling with these guys every single week. I mean, does a teacher really need to be out there with the
coach? I personally don't think so. I think everybody's different. Every player is different, obviously. But I personally think that players would be better off if they self-discovered, if they allowed themselves the avenue of more self-discovery and figuring it out on the range, digging it out of the dirt, as Hogan said. I think that players would be better off if they did more of that, quite honestly, the players who aren't doing that. And then going back to the teacher and saying, hey, this is what I found out. What do you think? You know? And having a healthy discussion in that regard, you know, taking good notes. Like I used to do that with John, with Kennedy all the time. John and I would, you know, I saw him 4 times a year. I saw him at 3 majors. He'd come with me to the Masters, the US Open and the PGA. And then I saw him at the AT&T Pebble Beach. And that's it. Maybe I'd stop in Northern California when I'd go see my mom or something like that. And I'd go down to the range and we literally, it was like a Jack Grout, Jack Nicklaus lesson. We'd BS for 45 minutes and then actually talk about my golf swing for 15 in an hour, you know? It's one of those things where, I put the onus more on the player. It's their life. It's their career. Own it, man. Own it. You know, use the guys to your best, use teachers to the best of your ability, but have a filter. I think so many players miss the filter. They take in whatever. And then before you know it, you've got a jumble, gobbledygook, all kinds of stuff up there, and you can't make sense of anything. And that's bad. That's obviously a bad thing. You got to have clarity out there. And I think that the best players have the most clarity.
I just want to interrupt this interview real quick and give a shout out to my friends over at Encore Golf. Encore provides some of the most cutting-edge technology in a golf ball that I have ever seen. Their team in Buffalo, New York is changing the script of golf technology through their perimeter-weighted designs, which offer players enhanced accuracy and control for every shot on the course. With their award-winning Elixir and Avant 55 golf balls, they are transforming the game for players of all skill levels. Visit EncoreGolf.com/Travis Fulton for more details about their products that are revolutionizing the game. Now back to the Stripe Show?
It's such an interesting, dynamic. You know, my 20 years of teaching, I elected years and years ago. I didn't want to live that life and travel. And I had some small opportunities and felt like I could have made a go of it and gotten out there and made myself more available to do those things. Worked with Fred Funk for a long time, early in his Champions Tour career and some others, but never traveled, And so for me, and knowing a lot of these guys that have done it full time, I have a lot of respect for them. And it's such an interesting dynamic when you have this player coach relationship, the player is doing this, for a living, and you're trying to play this role the best that you can, because, A, it's what you love to do, but B, what it can mean for your career, right? A lot of these guys, they've built their name in working with the best players in the world. And I think, frankly, we tend to credit teachers who are working with PGA Tour players as the best teachers.
Sure.
Right, wrong, or indifferent. Like I look at it this way,
Travis. They're also working with the best players who have the best feels, the best everything,
right?
The best body movements, the best. I mean, I'll be very honest with you. I am not, we all know I'm not an instructor. I'm a PGA Tour player turned TV analyst, and I understand the PGA Tour game very well. However, mm-hmm. if you're going to ask me to take Mrs. Havakamp, who's a 20 handicapper, and turn her into a 10, I got no chance. Zero prayer. That's where a yeah. real instructor like yourself blows the doors off of me. But for instance, my buddy Parker McLaughlin, who I work with every once in a while. I understand things, the stuff that I understand that he needs to do in his golf swing. I also get from George Gankus and Shaheen Nakhchivani, trying to get Parker to do certain things. Well, I understand what he's trying to do. I see a couple of things in Parker's swing. I want to do this. I want to tweak that. Just subtle changes. But he's got the ability to make the movements necessary in one swing. So these best teachers are all mm-hmm. the best athletes in the world. So that's the thing. Now, you take Mrs. Yeah. Havakamp and you take her from a 20 to a 10, boy, you are a teacher. You are a teacher.
Well, there's certainly different different teachers
for sure.
out there making different livings, and the scope has gotten bigger in the social media platform. A couple guys that you mentioned who are very big in the social media platform, but also working with the more skilled player. And I look at that relationship back to what I was saying with the coach and the player, and how much time is spent not just in person, but them traveling with them, but on the phone and texting. And I'm thinking to myself, man, these guys are the best players in the world. They are the most skilled golfers in the world. And from my experience and working with Fred and others, I always felt that I was more productive when I was creating that environment for them to self-discover, for them to come to me with answers, maybe with a question, rather than me trying to tell them exactly what I think they should do. And I just think sometimes it could be so overdone out there. It's almost like you're coddling them to some degree, and you're not creating that environment for them to take that full responsibility of self-discovery of what they're trying to get out there and do, which is ultimately
exactly right. And I agree with you. That's the kind of teacher I want for me personally. And if my boys get into it, that's the kind of teacher I want them to have, is one that's into self-discovery. And not going to tell them your elbow's off. You need to get your elbow here. There's a certain amount of technical expertise that you need, I think, to a certain extent, but you're a lot built in your DNA and what you learn physically as a young person all the way through maybe your early teens, that kind of sticks with you and what you're able to do and to change. You can't change your DNA, obviously. And that gets into your swing DNA, and then your swing forms. And it's up to, I guess, the parent or whoever or the coach to someone at a young age to either, okay, do I want to take the potential genius out of this kid and get him position oriented potentially and thinking too much about, gosh, my elbow right? Or do I want to get this person more routine target oriented? Because, I think it's a hard balance to manage at that point for the teacher and the student relationship. And as it in regards to the PGA Tour, I think there's a lot of theory out there. There's a lot of theory out there, and there's a lot of pretty swings, but I'm not, but they also have to have practical application. They have to shoot scores, and scores add up to dollars or FedEx Cup points, however you want to look at it. And that's ultimately what players judge themselves on. And those FedEx Cup points, if you make enough of them, add up to a nice trophy. So it's practical application of these theories that really counts the most. And if you're not making, if the teacher isn't making that proper practical application, then all is for naught. You can make a pretty golf.
Yeah. You know, and back to this, interview that, you know, Brandel Chamblee had with Golf Week, when you read that, and he had a lot of things to say about modern teaching, when you read that, my initial reaction was Brandel
made a lot of good points, quite honestly. I think he kind of shock jocked it a little bit too much, in my humble opinion. But that's Brandel, quite honestly. He's blunt. He's to the point. And that's why I appreciate him. And that's why he's good at what he does, quite honestly, is that he's not going to sugarcoat things. He's going to kind of tell you how it is. And I think that kind of ruffled some feathers, without a doubt. I think we all know it ruffled quite a few feathers in the teaching industry. But that's maybe what he wants. Quite honestly, maybe he wants to get people mad and understand that there's a different way to look at this thing. You know, I'm a product, to his point, I'm a product of the David Ledbetter 80s and 90s teaching institution, where everybody came along and saw David Ledbetter and said, look at all the success he's having with Nick Faldo. And I remember using the David, I don't know if you remember it, Travis, but the David Ledbetter swing link that went around your chest and then went around your arm. Oh, yeah. And I had a guy on Twitter ask me the other day, why is your elbow so tucked? Basically, his question was, I'm paraphrasing, why is your elbow so tucked to your side? Your elbow's not. And I said, well, that's using 15 to 6. I pretty much started every session I hit balls with the David Ledbetter swing link, you know, trying to figure out how to keep the club more in front of me and more around my body and not get my arm so separated from my body. It was Nick Price. It was those guys that Ledbetter was teaching back then that were kind of the model. So kind of, I think a lot of teachers went in that direction to a certain extent. Restrict the hips, turn, you know, the X factor type stuff like Jim McClain, restrict the hips, turn the shoulders more. Well, we understand now through revisionist history to a certain extent that those teachers didn't have the same tools that you guys have nowadays. They didn't have TrackMan. They didn't have 3D motion capture. They didn't have all those tools at their disposal so they were looking at golf swings thinking, okay, where do we create power? But they were just looking at videos. They didn't have actual numbers. They didn't have actual measure tools like we have today, power plates and so on and so forth. So I think the teachers of today, there are no excuses really for the teachers of today. They have everything. It's never been a better time in the history of golf to be an instructor than it is right now, in my opinion, because of all of the tools at your disposal as an instructor.
Yeah.
And so there's no excuses. You can diagnose things so much quicker, so much easier. But then at that point, that's when you have to become a real instructor. How do I apply to what I know is the problem? How do I attack that problem? And I think that's where we find out who the good teachers are and who the teachers are who need to learn a few more things.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's the application of, you know, A, B, and C. And I think if we'll talk for the amateur golfer here now. And, you know, I always say, look, there's a difference between great information and then great information in the right order. There's a lot of great information out there. But at the end of the day, and I remember when I was training a lot of young teachers getting into the business, I said, you got to go out there. You have to invest in great information. Science is available to you now, and it's going to continue to change your thought process and how you view things. It has me, and it will probably continue. I mean, if you're not evolving and you're teaching the game exactly today as you were 10 years ago, then you probably need to take a look at yourself a little bit. So that's always going to continue to evolve to some degree. But I also encourage them to take the time on the presentation of it, the application of it, and putting things in the right order for people. So at the end of the day, for amateur golfers, you're improving the probability of impact. And as you're improving that probability of impact, you know, they're able to hit more shots. They're able to develop more skill. I think when you get on the tour level, their skill is so high anyway. I was just going to say it real quick. It's interesting, the perception. I think from the outside looking in, if I was an amateur golfer, is that it's technique. That's the difference, that it's this small technical thing that we see from a lot of the teachers. But the reality is it isn't. It's really between the ears, isn't it? That's the difference for most of these guys to take that.
I think each player is different. I think there could be a technical change, a very, very small, minute technical change that might give a player confidence. Oh my gosh. You know, when players talk about, I found something on the range, which you don't hear that a lot, actually. You know, guys, you know, like my old coach used to say, Roger, to find it on Wednesday, you got to dance with who brought you there that week, because usually you're not going to find it. So rarely you will find something during a tournament and go, oh, click, there it is. But that's that maybe one little tiny minute technical timing piece, something maybe you're only something just to that player makes sense that clicks, and you're flushing it. And that's a great confidence builder, especially if you discovered on your own as a player. That's what gives you massive loads of confidence, because that's that is ingraining in you the understanding of your own golf swing and what you need to do, versus a teacher telling you, hey, you're not rotating, you're not pronating your right forearm, you know, enough. Which, you know, even players on PGA Tour are going to be like, well, what? I mean, how the hell do I do that? You know, how to do it, but where do I do that? When do I do that? How should I do that? So it's a tricky balance for a teacher on the PGA Tour versus, I think, the average teacher who teaches the masses. I mean, the real heroes of the game, the club pros, the guys who are in the trenches day in and day out, giving lessons to the amateurs. Those amateurs, to your point, they're, because they don't know what to ask. They don't know what they don't know themselves as golfers. And so I think that's a little bit tougher. So that teacher has a little bit more onus on them to really give them good information for what's going on at the tour level. This is why I put most of it on a tour player, 51%. You have to be communicative to that teacher 24/7 and tell them everything that you're feeling, everything that's going on, and question constantly. So that you have an absolute understanding of what you're doing as a player. And if you're not doing that, then you're going to let in all kinds of stuff that maybe you shouldn't let in. I think that's really crucial. And listen, at that level, there can't be any hard feelings. It is strictly business.
And it's inevitable, really, that as a coach, you're going to get fired. I mean, these players have so many options, and, you know, there are some examples like we see with Spieth and McCormick, which we'll get to here in a second, that have been together for a long time. Rory McIlroy and Michael Bannon, like, there are examples of that. But for the most part, teacher, at some point, no matter how much success you've had, you're going to get fired, right? I mean, Tiger and Butch split, you know, Phil Mickelson and Rick Smith split. Like, these guys had a lot of success together. And it's just inevitable that, you know, for whatever reason, they're going to part ways. You know, I read Brandel's interview and, you know, he does make a lot of good points. I mean, I think Brandel is very good at what he does in his chair, very well researched, obviously bringing a very insightful message. I think from a teacher standpoint, looking at it, where it probably, at least for me, not to speak for other teachers, but certainly the outrage that is out there. I think the broad strokes were probably a little too aggressive in kind of putting everybody into this bucket of, as he put it, quote, being bitch slapped. You know, the idiocy is probably a very strong word. I'll be the first to admit I've made a lot of mistakes as a teacher and have put some things out there that I probably wish I would have said a little bit differently. And I think, you know, Brandel's very, very opinionated on what he thinks in the golf swing, and he speaks in the way as a teacher. And I think for speaking on behalf of the instruction world, we would love to see him, you know, get a piece of turf, right, and start to teach and start putting a lot of the things to fruition and to get results. Because the reality is when you get into the trenches with people, and particularly the better level player out on tour, you're having to manage a lot of things. And I can tell you, just in the experience that I've had, you know, you're working with a player and sometimes this is where you want to go. And as you mentioned, as a player, I'm not going to do that. This is not where I want to go. So there's this give and take. I think there's a lot of smoke and mirrors at times. There were times I was having a conversation with a player. I was like, if someone was videoing the last 45 minutes of this conversation, they would just sit there and be like, what in the hell are these guys talking about? They just went in this complete circle.
Massive.
The human element is a big part of it. And I think when you start throwing around words like, you know, the idiocy and these big broad strokes, I can fix speed swing in 2 seconds. You know, I giggle when I read this or I watch this with a coach. It just kind of screams arrogance to me. And that's what I think rubs the teacher the wrong way. And I think that's where we'd like to see, hey, why don't you get yourself a piece of turf? Yeah. And then we can kind of go from there, since you're talking as a teacher. But with all that said, you know, I think, Brandel does make some good points about modern teaching. I think he makes one of the points that he made about Jordan Spieth and Cameron McCormick. You know, this is an example, and I got to tell you, you know, Spieth's been struggling. Now, we're pushing on 2 years, Aaron. You know, we're pushing on 2 years here for this guy to be struggling. He has really shown a lot of trust with Cameron McCormick, who I think is a very good coach, but something is not working there. And I'm not putting the blame on one or the other, but something is not working to get Jordan Spieth to the point where he's not snap hooking it in terms of play.
I think that, again, I am not privy to any conversations that he or Cameron McCormick are having. I don't think any of us are, except for maybe Michael Greller, maybe Jay Danzy, his manager. Those are about the only guys. Those four guys probably know what's really, really going on. The rest of us are just left to ponder and make educated guesses, as educated as we can, about what's going on. From a player's standpoint, he has put a lot of trust in Cameron. And I said on air at the Players Championship when we were watching him on the range, I said, I think he needs a new set of eyes. I said it on air, and I back that up. I think he does. I think Jordan does need a new set of eyes. And much like when I went from my coach, John Kennedy, for 4 months in a cup of coffee with Peter Kostas my rookie year, thinking that I might need another set of eyes down here in Scottsdale, and thinking that I was making the right move, Spieth might do the same thing with another teacher, and he'll go, oh no, this isn't working for me. I need to go back. And he that might be the case, or it could be just the opposite. He'd go, oh, this is exactly what I need. Now I'm in the right positions. Now I can do what I need to do. Now, boy, my iron game's coming back, and boom, and then the light's coming on, and it's all over again. He's a top 10 player in the world, and back to contending in major championships and winning them again. That could be the situation.
Right.
But I do think that at this point, I don't think it would be bad. And I think it would be, I think if Cameron really, really loves the kid and really, really wants to see him do well, he'll sit there and he'll go, Jordan, I've tried everything. I don't know what's going on, but I think we need to find someone who really can diagnose your issue and really get you going where you want to go. That's, I mean, teachers have got a lot of teachers out there have got to swallow their egos at times and just do what's best for the player and not what's best potentially for their business at times and really do what's best for the player.
Yeah.
It is tough.
That's a tough one, you know, for a teacher. And I've lived that a handful of times over the years, and speaking from experience there, where, you know, you know, things are going good. And then all of a sudden, you know, you go through this period of time where it's like, you know, something is not happening here. The player is not performing. And as a coach, it's really easy to say, well, he's just not doing what I'm asking him to do. I understand the science.
Then you're either applying the science
is something is
to
failing.
That student, and or you're not communicating the science properly.
Yeah,
that's what I would say.
Yeah, right. So exactly. So, and there's just times where you just it's just not happening as a coach. And I think you have to be able to step away, and you have to be able to swallow your pride, to your point, and say, you know what, it just didn't work out for me in that situation. I didn't do a good job with that player. I didn't get him wants to go. It doesn't make you a bad coach. I do think in this world, teachers.
Absolutely.
You know, I think
everybody's got an ego. Everybody's got an ego. And that's to be, I guess, expected to a certain extent. But I think it's up to the teacher at that point. If the player is just racking his head, And quite honestly, it's up to Jordan sometimes to go, Cameron, this is not working, dude. We got to find something else because this isn't working for me. I can't be negative half a shot in strokes gained approach and driving and expect to compete at any level.
Yeah. Were you surprised when Brooks traveled to see Butch?
A little bit. It did.
At first. Yeah.
It kind of raised an eyebrow. I wasn't like, whoa, but it kind of raised an eyebrow for me for sure. And again, that's a phenomenal example of family of teachers who are all phenomenal golf people and have ridiculous knowledge of the golf swing and golf in general. And here is a father who are both very good teachers, phenomenal teachers, but maybe they speak different languages and see different things. And Claude couldn't see exactly what Butch could see or did and couldn't communicate it to Brooks the way he wanted it communicated. That could have been the case. I don't know for a fact, but it was enough for Brooks to go because he knows it's business. It's not personal. It's business. Hop on that plane, go see Butch. Mm-hmm. Butch diagnoses it in four swings because either A, he saw something that Claude didn't and or he communicated what Claude did see in a different way so that Brooks could understand it a little bit better. There can't be any hard feelings. And even though it's really hard, I understand for teachers, there can't be any hard feelings in this business. The ultimate goal of a teacher is support, and it should always be support for the player. And that should be your number one. That should be your number one mantra. How do I support this player so that they can play their best? And if you're not thinking like that, in my humble opinion, as an instructor, you're in the wrong business.
Yeah. And I think for the most part, these guys do, at least from my interaction with him and my resources. Cameron McCormick seems like a terrific support guy to me, and probably would take a step back if needed, or maybe he has tried already. I don't know. But he seems like that very much that support kind of guy. I think Claude Hermann III is very much like that, and probably,
I know Claude's like that because I walked nine holes with Claude the Monday of the Players, and he was out there walking with Siwoo Kim for nine holes and just for support. I didn't see them hardly talk about a thing, but just reassuring Siwoo that he was doing the right things. That's it.
Yeah.
You know, no, it's not. Yeah. It's not.
Yeah. Not an easy job. I got a lot of respect for those guys.
There's no roadmap
for those guys. There's no blueprint to it. And it's just there isn't. And it's just funny. It's just not funny, but it's fun to see and to watch from a distance and knowing a lot of them. I know how hard they work. The hours these guys put in is it's remarkable when you're starting to work with two or three different players and how much time they put out there. Last combination here, Ricky Fowler, Butch decided not to travel. I know Claude kind of walked with him a little bit, but he's decided to move over to John Tillery, someone that I know very well. He worked with Kevin Kisner, worked with Scott Brown. And he's done a nice job with those guys. And, Ricky is coming over and making some wholesale changes. I mean, what I see when I watch him working on his swing now, I see a player who is trying to load a little bit more into the right side. I see a player trying to set the club more vertically and a little bit more across the line and a little less laid off.
Massive.
Which are pretty good size changes. And back to Brandel's interview, he felt, those kinds of changes are, not always in the best.
I agree 100% with Brandel on this one.
Like it, Ricky's example.
When you're trying to go from, all right, how do I say this in teacher speak, since I'm not a teacher, but I've learned a lot from you guys over the last few years, the new school speak that Joe Mayo got me on. When you're trying to go from when you're extremely flat and your trail shoulder's totally externally rotated and you've got no more external rotation in that shoulder, the only way you can go, since you can't drop it any more underneath and flatten it out anymore, is to pitch it steep, right? Which is where Ricky is. Am I right, Travis? Okay. So exactly. So he steepens it on the way down.
Yes, yes,
and you're
yes,
asking him now, or he wants to, or you're asking him now to take it back, get it and stand the shaft up a little bit more vertically and leave room to now where you can externally rotate the trail shoulder, drop it inside and drop it more underneath versus, so now you're flattening it. So you're going from flat to steep and now you want to go to steep to flat. Man, that is massive. That is like, that's, I mean,
that's big.
I mean, that's deconstructing the Leaning Tower of Pisa and putting it back the same way. I mean, I don't know how, I don't know how that's going to happen, but it is going to be very, very difficult, in my humble opinion, for Ricky, that massive of a change. I just think he at this point in his career, he is who he is, and he is going to be hot. He's going to be cold. He is going to hit incredible shots. Yep. He's going to hit some shots that make you go, huh, well, where'd that come from? And I think that's all part of his DNA. And there's nothing wrong with that, quite honestly. I think Ricky can win a major with what he has right now. I don't think he needs anything else. So if John thinks that he can get this done, more power to him. I do have my doubts, though, as a player who kind of understands what Ricky's trying to do to a certain extent. That's a difficult switch. Massive change.
Yeah, that's a big change for sure. And and I think, you know, it's very much in line with, you know, the rhetoric that you see on social media and taught, you know, predominantly, right? The shallowing of the shaft, facilitating rotation with the body through impact. There's not many players that steepen it.
Jason Day steepens it. Ricky steepens it.
Most of his career. Jason Day's a little steep. Leishman,
Phil steep.
You know, brings it down steep. Yep. Phil Mickelson probably, coming down with the lead wrists extended, you know, the steepness of the shaft and extended lead wrist coming down, cupped for those that don't know what extended is, you know, that's kind of,
well, a lot of, on chalkboard, yeah, a lot, a lot know, of the new school teachers, that is, they just, the, they're just like, they see it and they go, we got to change that. So,
yeah, right. So it's interesting time right now, I think. And, you know, we know a lot. The science is there. I think speed creation has obviously taken over the PGA Tour, and amateur golfers are trying to get more speed. They're just trying to hit it straighter, you know, at the end of the day and enjoy the game. Don't roll the damn ball back for the amateur. But it, you know, the science in TrackMan has whittled it down, I think, to this is what we know. Mm-hmm. To be the best from a science standpoint. And I hope that with that information, that we don't coach the DNA out. We don't coach the genius out. And I think we have enough smart people in the game at all levels that will continue to learn from our mistakes and that will continue to communicate in the right way, and will continue to move the needle forward and make the professional golfer the best that they can be. Because you can't deny from top to bottom.
It's incredible.
The level of play right now is so extraordinary good. It's just ridiculous. The Korn Ferry Tour, which you've won twice on, the Canadian Tour, which you've won twice on. I see these guys.
There are
you're on the last
a bunch
tour?
Of.
I mean, like.
On those tours going, man, I need to get a shot. I mean, so good. You've definitely got to do what you got to do to separate yourself.
Yeah.
You there? Someone called, sorry. It's hard to separate days. It's really hard to separate yourself.
Yeah. It is. And you just hope that, you know, like you said, the players make the right decision for themselves because they are the owner, you know, of their own enterprise and make the right decisions for themselves to protect their talent and their genius. And I think we will. I think we continue to evolve. We continue to get better. The level of play is just ridiculous right now. And I'm excited for them to get back to work here at the end of the May. And I appreciate, Aaron, I appreciate you coming on the Stripe Show podcast.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of the Stripe Show podcast. I'm Travis Fulton. We'll see you next time.